So have you noticed that when you look?
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. And we have two bills on for public hearing. I'm counting legislators to see who's got the most legislators here. We will start with House Bill 4005.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4005, as it came from the House, would expand the number of enterprise zones from 10 to 15 and would allow the enterprise zone to be expanded in some areas. The revenue impact is approximately $300,000 per biennium for this change.
Okay. We have Senator Beyer.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from Central Lynn and Lincoln, Central Lynn and Lane counties. Going back a long way to get to Lincoln in that matter. Madam Chair, this is a fairly simple bill. I'm here to support it. It simply extends the number of e-commerce zones from 10 to 15. We talked about it a bit in the last session, you might recall. I'm here today because it has the potential to have a big impact in my district, and I think some of the benefits that you've seen elsewhere in terms of getting a what's been essentially a dead facility, very large facility, a former computer memory chip plant back in business. This one could put it over the edge, not as a chip plant, but as a multi-use electronic commerce center, if you will. It's a former Hynex plant, if you may have heard of it out there. It's a huge building, and we've been trying for about 8 years to get it back onto the tax rolls without much luck, and this is a chance that we might work. But beyond that, I think this is a program that has great benefit to the smaller communities, rural communities in Oregon. I've seen it. One of the few things that you can get going in those areas, things like call centers and some of the others, which you don't get too excited about them in an urban setting, but if you look at the smaller rural areas, those are great kinds of facilities that you want to see there. They fit, they'll work, and they need a little edge sometimes, a little sweetener to get the game going. The revenue impact statement that you have in front of you, talking with Mr. Warner, there hasn't been a lot of impact from these things, and I think that makes sense if you think about it in terms of when businesses start up or do this, they really don't make a lot of money. Profits, so they're not very taxable in the first couple of years, so you don't have that as much negative impact from it as maybe some of the other programs like the gain share. So anyway, Madam Chair, it's a good thing. It'd be very helpful. It's potentially worth 400 or 500 jobs in my community, and getting a big facility back on the tax rolls, which excites me. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Okay. This has a number of enterprise of e-zones, a number, you know, it's more than you'd need for Eugene. Do you know why the bill was structured that way?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I think it is. It's probably. I think we started talking about three. The way this works from the Business Oregon, the Economic Development Department, is it's a competitive thing. There's no assurance that anyone will get it. There's a competitive process. All the 10 that are there now are currently conveyed to one community or another, so there's none available. We thought it would make sense to have them have a few more tools, whether it's three or five. I don't know why they went to five. It is what it is. Okay. That's the bill you have in front of you.
Some of us thought it was mysterious. We thought you might.
It did receive strong support in the other chamber. So.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions of Senator Beyer? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Toward the end of the session, there are all kinds of amendments floating around to everything at this time. And I just want to clarify that today's hearing is only on the underlying bill without regard to any amendments that may or may not be added to it. And if there were to be amendments added to it, there would be a public process for that as well. Okay, Chris Fick, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Burdick, other members of the committee, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. We are supportive of House Bill 4005. As Senator Beyer just said, we know that there's a need for these e-commerce zones throughout the state. Not only is Eugene looking to make use of one, but Beaverton, Gresham, and Independence are also would also be interested in seeking these e-commerce designations. Just as a quick background, we know these are effective economic development tool. Some of our rural communities, Grants Pass, Jackson County, have been very successful in locating businesses and allowing for their growth and expansion. Fire Mountain Gems, for example, has used one of these e-commerce zones to employ 500 people. Motorcycle Accessories employs over 200 people in the same area. And the First Call Resolution Center, which operates in Roseburg but has a call center in Southern Oregon as well, employs almost 200 people. Just by way of background, these e-commerce zones have to be located in existing enterprise zones. To be designated an enterprise zone, you have to have a median household income of 80% of the statewide average or an unemployment rate 2 percentage points higher than the statewide average for the most recent annual year. So these are good middle-class jobs that are targeted towards communities that need them most. And we think that five would be a good investment for both the state and for our local communities.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? All right. Thank you very much. Jody Weiser.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, representing Taxpayers Oregon. It probably would come as no surprise to any of you that we oppose this bill because we've heard no real justification for it. There's the comment you just heard about how this would be good for rural Oregon, and then you heard the names of mostly urban Oregons who would be applicants for it. We asked last week OBDD for a list of the current and prior recipients of it, and they referred us to the Department of Revenue, which referred us back to the OBDD. I think that the department is going to try to get the information, but we don't have it yet. And so where's the analysis? Where's the analysis that tells us this is something we want to do? Where do we have how many jobs this has brought and what they've paid? We do have the opportunity to look at the underlying E-zones, and for instance, in Hillsboro, we've pay per job a five-year tax abatement that cost us between $280 a job and $17,500 a job, repeated every year for 5 years. Totally affordable to say we'll pay $280 for a job for 5 years. Well, we do that five times in a row. Kind of unaffordable to say the state will put out $17,500 for
a job. What program are you talking about?
The underlying, in addition to the e-commerce zone, they have to be in an enterprise zone. And the cost of this tax abatement for the enterprise zone is as high as $17,500 per
job. You're talking
job.
About enterprise zones and not SIPs,
well,
correct?
Right. And in the job, and we just started looking at the county that gave the city that gave the best reports on the transparency website happens to be Hillsboro, so we did the analysis of that data. This bill says, in addition to not paying any property taxes, we will pay 25% of their costs. And it's capped, but it's capped at $2 million a business. So these are businesses that are largely not going to have a storefront that's paying property tax. Only the place where their call center people or their whoever handles orders is. So we clearly, I shop online. You probably all shop online. It's more convenient than driving to a store. Go to three or four stores, whatever. But it is undermining our ability to raise property taxes someplace else and to say we will give you part of your capital expenses in addition to giving you 5 years of no taxes when there is no relationship between the quality or number of jobs and the amount we're giving them. Just doesn't make sense. We need to develop a tool that where what we give bears a relationship to what we get. And it's we can't no jobs are are probably paying $17,500 a year in income taxes, and yet we're abating that much in property taxes. And so we're losing money on those jobs. And we shouldn't be doing something that expansive. And this, it's like, we want five more. We want a 50% expansion. But what are we getting? And I don't think we should just go on building programs bigger when we don't know what the program is in terms of return on investment for the taxpayers.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you, Jody. Okay, is there anybody else who wanted to testify on House Bill 4005? Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 4005, and we will take this up on Wednesday. And now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4138.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4138 is a bill that modifies the method of corporate apportionment of business income for interstate broadcasters. The bill defines terms and basically changes the basis of apportionment from one based on the viewing audience to one based on the gross receipts of the Oregon domicile of the customers. There's a six-year sunset, so it would apply for tax years 2014 through 2019, and it requires the Legislative Revenue Office to produce a report on the impact and the utilization of the policy change.
Okay, Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
How's your stomach feeling today?
Yeah. I managed okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Burdick, Co-Chair George, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson, and I represent House District 47, which is in East Portland. Today, I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 4138. This bill seeks to modernize the method of apportioning state taxes for interstate broadcasters. The current method of apportionment was adopted more than 25 years ago when there were only three network television stations, and people received those stations through antennas on the top of their house. The current method of apportionment is based on an estimate of audience size. And as technology is developing and changing the how and where audience get their broadcasting, the method is becoming problematic. More viewers are watching their television content on their computers, their phones, their tablets, and there's no way to predict when or where people are watching. So this current method of taxation is confusing and outdated. The proposed changes in House Bill 4138 create a modern method of taxing the receipts. They tax them by the receipts based on the commercial domicile of internet broadcasting customers. The broadcasters have two distinct customer groups. One are national and local advertisers that pay advertising, who buy advertising, and local stations and networks that pay program licensing fees. So the new method that's proposed in this bill apportions sales to Oregon that come from these groups of broadcasters and customers that are actually domiciled in Oregon. Changing the basis of the apportionment from viewing audiences to gross receipts from these companies makes sense for today's technology, and it makes clear who and where the interstate broadcasters' customers are. The intent of this legislation is to ensure that both cable program networks and over-the-air broadcast networks are taxpayers covered by this legislation. This bill will only impact interstate broadcasters and does not impact other taxpayers who may provide programming directly to retail customers. And there's a -A8 amendment that actually clarifies this intent. So you can think of this bill as doing really three things. It provides certainty for both the Department of Revenue and the broadcast industry by changing the method of apportionment. It also, as Chris mentioned, has a sunset of 2020, so we can make sure that the impact of this legislation is having the effect that we anticipate. And includes language that directs LRO to report on this so that in 2020 we can make changes if it's deemed necessary. So thank you for the chance to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I think this is probably the clearest description I've ever heard for this bill. Congratulations.
Thank you. It helps being on the House Revenue Committee, I will tell
you. Well, I'm on the Senate Revenue Committee, and it didn't help me for a while. So thank you for bringing this forward and for taking this on, because this is one of those issues that it takes a lot of study and a lot of technical knowledge to work your way through this.
Yeah, I felt like I was doing my homework on this one.
Yes, you definitely were, and you've done that on other things as well. Are there questions from the committee? All right, thank you very much. Now we have signed up Scott Berry and Brian O'Leary. Those are serious crutches.
Solid teak.
Wow.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Berry. I'm here on behalf of the Motion Picture Association of America in support of House Bill 4138. With me today is Brian O'Leary from NBC Universal to kind of walk you through the technical issues in the bill, the reason for the change in tax policy, and any answer any questions that you might have. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brian O'Leary.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I feel like my work is done. Representative Vega Peterson did do a very good job of describing this bill. So rather than I'll try to avoid trotting the same ground and just perhaps amplify what you've already heard. But a little background on who I am. I'm tax counsel with NBC Universal. You may know NBCU is a company that produces and distributes the television series Grimm on the NBC network, which is called Oregon Home for the last 3 years and hopefully for many more. But more broadly, NBCU is a media and entertainment company that owns and operates two over-the-air broadcast networks as well as 18 cable programming network, so the sort of taxpayers, interstate taxpayers, that the representative described. NBCU is part of the Motion Picture Association of America, which includes other large media and entertainment companies, Viacom, Disney, Time Warner, CBS, Sony, and Fox. And the profiles of those companies are virtually identical to what I've just described for NBCU. So we are here in support of House Bill 4138 for the reasons that the representative described. It provides a contemporary method of taxing the income of our industry as interstate broadcasters. And just a little bit on how income apportionment works here, income taxation works in Oregon, as it does in just about every state. The state looks to a company's total sales and tries to decide how much of those total sales are actually in Oregon. And that percentage, 10, 15, whatever the number is the amount of income that that company earns that will be taxed in Oregon. So the question is, what's an Oregon sale? If we're a widget manufacturer or any other seller of tangible personal property, we know what the answer is. If I have customers in Oregon, I'm selling to my Oregon customers, those are Oregon sales. So that number over our total sales is the percentage of income that we're taxed. What the representative had described, under existing Oregon law for interstate broadcasters, they use a system that looks at viewers, subscribers in Oregon as a percentage of nationwide. It's basically a demographic test. And this old rule actually has its roots more than 25 years ago, back when there were just three networks in the U.S., and we would distribute our programming to local television stations, and those local television stations would distribute their programming to their viewers. So it was a very, very simple system. What has happened, however, is time, technology, and competition have had a transformative effect on our industry. So there are no longer three broadcast, over-the-air broadcast networks. There is a proliferation of cable programming networks. So we still, thankfully, have NBC and CBS and ABC, but what we also have is cable programming networks like ESPN, Bravo Company, MSNBC, the NBC Sports Network. Hopefully you're all familiar with it now, having just come off 2 weeks of the Olympics, and hopefully you'll stay with that network. But those are cable programming networks, and there are hundreds of them. And as much as there has been an expansion of our industry and the competition in our industry, there's also been a expansion of who our customers are. Advertisers, first and foremost, and then the companies that we license our programming to. So advertisers, Columbia Sports, Oregon Scientific, Nike, and you could go on. So it's the large Oregon customers are the ones that are our advertisers, just as GM is a large advertiser in Michigan. And then, of course, we have our local stations that we license syndicated programming to, our daytime talk shows. Those are also our customers. And then multi-system cable networks, I'll describe it that way, Comcast, Cox Communication, as well as DirecTV. Those are our customers. And one of the large burgeoning segments of our customer base are Internet sites like Netflix and Hulu. So that is the customer base in the most succinct terms, that are the relationships that we generate as an industry. We generate our revenue through. So, if we were a widget manufacturer and we were looking at who our customers were that we were selling to in Oregon, that would be our Oregon sales. Technology has also had an incredible impact on the end users. So, the viewers, those that access the content, if you look today where we are as a viewing or subscriber community, think about it in this context. People can access content wherever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And that means that access to content that we create and distribute through our customers is accessed on tablets, mobile devices such as smartphones, laptops, game consoles. There is an exponential increase in the ability of individuals to access our content. They have been untethered from their TV sets. So if you think just for a minute how the existing Oregon rule works to attribute income from interstate broadcasters to the state, looking to viewers in Oregon or subscribers in Oregon, even if it was the right way to look at our industry, if they were our customers, which they're not, you wouldn't be able to trust that as a reliable proxy for our sales in the state, because the end users are accessing content at a variety of means, and most of the time, and this will continue, it's not sitting in their home. So from the interstate broadcaster's perspective, House Bill 4138 right-sizes the relationship with Oregon in a way that allows us to attribute our sales to the state and be taxed in a method that reflects our relationships with our customers. So in-state advertisers, local television stations that we do business with, MSOs that we do business with, websites that we do business with. If they're Oregon customers, that's what goes in our Oregon sales, and our total sales is the portion that you determine our method of taxation on. So just a quick point, how do we determine what our customer is, where our customer is? The bill looks to the commercial domicile of our customers and uses the method in Oregon law, a definition of commercial domicile that already exists in statute. And this is the same method that other states that have recently evaluated how to tax our industry have used. They look at our customers, they determine where our customers are based on the commercial domicile of those companies. Same way that North Carolina, Florida, Michigan, and Illinois have determined is the proper method of attributing sales to those states. So what we're talking about here is a tested method, a method that pivots off of existing Oregon law and will allow us to, as the representative said, predictably measure our income in a way that is non-manipulable and will allow an easy audit trail for the Department of Revenue as well as for the taxpaying community. So it is for those reasons that we respectfully request your consideration on House Bill 4138.
Thank you. Over here in Senate Finance and Revenue, we often have people coming in and asking for some change or other in the tax system, and it's usually so that they'll pay less taxes. But our revenue impact here says that we would actually gain a little bit of revenue from this change. So I'm wondering why, I see the rational reason why you're doing this, but is this because other states are doing it and you want national uniformity, or what is really driving this?
So the predictability is important for us. Part of just getting back to the way the existing law works, What is the viewing audience? What is the right measure? Those are the sorts of, as I described to you, technology makes it very difficult for us as an industry to actually tell you who are viewers, who are subscribers. Putting aside the fact that those are our customers, if that is the measure that we're going to be required to use in a state, it is a challenge. So there is disagreement and uncertainty. Uncertainty from a financial statement perspective is not a good thing for the business community, nor is it for a state. So we would rather pay incrementally more and avoid the risk and uncertainty as to who, what is the right viewership percentage, what is the right method of allocation, and just allow one steady approach for the industry and the state. And that is something, as you'd mentioned, other states that have evaluated our industry have recently adopted, and that is allows us to have certainty in all of those jurisdictions.
And how many states would you estimate have gone to this system? And have they gone from the viewership demographic system to this system, or did they have some other system?
So there are, that's part of the challenge. There are a variety of other systems. So the viewership demographic, proportional cost of performance or cost of performance. There are a number of other methods out there, but one common theme is that there had been in all of those other jurisdictions an interest in a contemporary method of taxing for our industry, and that gave us the opportunity to have these conversations about what is not just a method for today, but one that will continue to live on and essentially evolve with the industry and the continued advent of technology.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair?
Senator, are you going to venture into this, Senator Rosenbaum?
Well, not very far. So I guess my question would be, given even with this change, it seems like the technology is rapidly evolving. It's still going to be hard to determine in terms of people domiciled in Oregon exactly what share of your advertising revenues have been generated by customers getting their TV, you know, from everything through Apple to Hulu to Comcast to I don't know what the latest technology is. So when your client files their income taxes in Oregon, I assume we're going to have to rely on you to be able to calculate that as then, you know, monitored by the Department of Revenue. How are you going to do that?
So it's actually a simple path, and I should have been more clear on describing this. So we're not going to, as an industry, rely on that disaggregated viewership where people accessing our content on tablets. What we're going to do, provided this bill continues on, is look at who our customer is. So Nike, if we have a contract for advertising with Nike, then 100% of that contract with our customer is attributed to Oregon. And same by the same token, if we have a local television station that we're licensing Steve Harvey show to, 100% of that revenue will be attributed to that station. And by the same token, in Michigan, it would be the same answer. If we're licensing Steve Harvey to a show, to a station in Michigan, 100% of that sale, just as if we were selling tangible personal property. So it doesn't look at who our customers are anymore. It's looking at who we have a direct business relationship with, just like the rest of the business community pays their taxes in Oregon. So for us, it's Nike, Oregon Scientific, Columbia Sports. You go down the list of companies that we do business with that we have sales that are Oregon companies. Those will be the sales, the revenue that gets included in Oregon, and that will be the method of taxation. We'll always, in fact, we always know who our customers are. They're the ones who are paying. That's an easy method of auditing, and one the Department of Revenue can verify as well.
So just to follow up, so if I'm understanding this, it really has nothing to do with your advertising revenues. It's that customer's sales in Oregon that's going to determine the income that you apportion here. So if they sell a little here and a lot elsewhere, you're just going to pay on the percentage of their Oregon sales.
So for example, I'll stay with the NBC Sports Network. Okay, so that's one of our networks, and the NBC Sports Network has a contract with Columbia that Columbia provides $1 million. We're just picking numbers randomly. And they're going to, in return, we will provide their commercials on our network, on the NBC Sports Network. So as we calculate our tax return, that $1 million will be included in our Oregon sales. That would be an Oregon sale because we're doing business with an Oregon customer. The fact that that commercial is broadcast outside of Oregon is beside the point. Just as if we were selling tangible personal property. If our customer that we sold to is here, what they do with it, completely beside the point. It's easy to say, I've got a customer in Oregon. I was paid $1 million for that contract. That's an Oregon contract. It's an Oregon sale. That's always going to be an auditable trail. We'll always know where our customers are because those are the parties that we're doing business with and we're generating revenue from.
I think you're confusing the single sales factor.
Right.
And it you're really right. doesn't have anything to do with
right.
that.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, the single sales factor, that just tells you that the only method of attributing income within and without Oregon is your sales. That's why we're talking about sales. We're not talking about property or payroll or anything else. We're just talking about sales.
But in our context here, the single sales factor, in other words, Columbia Sportswear only has to be taxed on sales that are within Oregon. And so that we're not talking
yes.
about sales of boots and parkas.
Not at all.
We're talking about sales directly between you and them.
That's right.
Senator George.
I just want to make sure. You said something very profoundly easy, and I want to make sure this is kind of sums
up. I'd like to hear it as well.
you said that that previously you had been taxed on your customer's customer, which means the market share. Now what we're doing is we're just basically bringing it back one step, and your customers are who you're taxed on, and it doesn't matter what their audience is. It's what they pay in the state of Oregon. It's simple. So rather than you trying to calculate what your customer's distribution is, you only care about what your relationship is with your business partners, and that's it. And that's how it's simplified. Mike, is that
yes,
boiled down?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, that is correct. That is spot on.
It strikes me that there are going to be some real winner and loser states on this approach. For example, a state like Minnesota that has, I think, 18 or 19 Fortune 500 headquarters in their state would, I imagine, be a winner on something like this. Can you comment a little
sure.
bit on that, on how this will affect the kind of the interstate?
Certainly. So there is, just as demographics would play a role under the old audience rule, it's now a function of what are the companies that our industry does business with. That is a large company or a small company. The most important piece is, are they advertisers or are they licensing programming for us? So it's interesting. There are a lot of large companies that don't rely on advertising. It just so happens that Oregon, some of them I've just rattled off, are significant advertisers, not just on the national over-the-air broadcast networks, but on the cable networks as well. So it's, is this a jurisdiction that has companies that are domiciled in the state, and are they advertisers? And it might work out for Oregon, and to your point, there could be other jurisdictions that don't work out as well just because of their corporate profile.
But one of the more stable elements would be all of the states have stations that you have licensing agreements with.
We'd like to. I mean, that's, yes. The idea here is that the station groups or individual stations, whoever we license, they'd fill the middle of their day with programming, syndicated programming, and so forth, whether it's talk shows or other syndicated shows. So those are companies, again, that we do business with. And if they're domiciled in Oregon, then it's an Oregon sale, just like Columbia, Oregon Scientific would be.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Hess.
Thank you. You scooped me, and I had the same thought. You know, if you're in Michigan and General Motors is a client, and then we see some of those General Motors ads here, or they're carried by a cable company here in Oregon, that's treated as, there's no tax, there's no relationship to that. And it just strikes me that you name Nike and Columbia Sportswear, and then the list is not that long compared to Ohio, New York, or Illinois with domiciles, lots of companies. So I'm just surprised that the math is what it is based on.
In terms of the revenue?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, the way that and I could go on. We contract with the Portland Trailblazers. I mean, there's a longer list. It's not just Fortune 100 companies. And when you just think about the proliferation of cable programming networks, they're not all contracting with GM and Nike. There's actually a lot of smaller advertisers that are domiciled in your state that you may not have heard of, but they're important advertisers to some of our networks. And that's a function of the business enterprise in your state as compared to the demographics in your state. And it just so happens that the uptick of business under this formula as compared to the old demographics rule provides a slight uptick in additional revenues.
Senator Bertrand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for being a little late.
No problem.
I just want to clarify, is it where the company is based out of or where the contract is entered into? I'll give you an example. If Company A is based in a state, but you enter in a contract because Company A has an entity in another state, is it where the company is or where is the contract entered into?
Madam Chair, Senator Barshetta, the point that you make is there are some jurisdictions that use mailing address, where the contract's concluded. Oregon law, commercial domicile, is where the decision-making, it's where the operations of the company originate. So regardless of where we send our bill or where the contract is signed, if it's an Oregon-domiciled company, then it's an Oregon sale. So the clarity exists in the existing law, and that's an important point, not just for us, but also for the Department of Revenue. We're not creating something new here.
You know, that brings up a point, and there's been so much change in the industry. I may be out of, this may not be accurate, but the NBC affiliate here in Portland is KGW. But I believe that they are still a subsidiary of King TV in Seattle. So where would the tax go? Would it go to Oregon or would it go to Washington?
So if you have a station group, Madam Chair, where is the commercial domicile of that station group? Are they headquartered in Oregon? Are they headquartered in New York or somewhere else? So there are individual stations, individually owned stations, and then there are also station groups. So the question is, who is the owner and are they commercially domiciled in the state? It would be no different than Adidas North America, which is commercially domiciled here. So Reebok sales, TaylorMade sales on our golf channel, all of those sales would be attributed to Oregon, not to Germany or wherever their worldwide headquarters are. It's where the U.S. headquarters, the commercial domicile of that company. So that's no different than an advertiser or a business that we would license. Where is the commercial domicile of that company?
So it seems to me that you'd have a lot of advertisers, and you've rattled off a lot of them, but very few TV stations, because isn't Channel 6?
There's no locally owned.
There's none locally owned in Portland. Now, I don't know about Medford.
And we have some.
Medford might be, and Bend might be, but in Portland, I think they're all. What is Channel 6? That's Charter.
And it's a matter of who are we? And I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I didn't interrupt you. So it really is a function of if there are station groups, just like the cable operators. There are locally owned cable systems, and then there are national cable systems, and just as we contract with the national cable systems, we have to contract with the local cable systems, to distribute our programming. So if we're contracting with a domiciled company, whether it's a cable system, a station, or an advertiser, and that is the point. It's indifferent to what the relationship is as long as it's a customer of ours, and then if it's a customer of ours in Oregon, it would be an Oregon sale.
I might just add, Chair Burdick, that we had a number of questions like this on the House side as well, and a couple of things came from that. One was the sunset for exactly this reason, so we could track it, and LRO eventually will produce a report showing exactly what happened before the bill passed, and then what also will occur in terms of revenue and where the funds came in from, both advertising and licensees. And the licensing revenue was somewhere in the 30-35% range, the advertising money somewhere in the 65-70% range. That gives you a bit of a picture from
that is helpful
from the two sides.
So how many states have moved to this? I think I asked that before, but we got waylaid here.
Oh, that's okay. So of the states that have recently, so that over the last 3 years, made a change to apportion the income of our industry, 100%. But those are North Carolina, Florida, Michigan, and Illinois. It's a function of what jurisdictions are actually looking to update their laws, and all of those jurisdictions were going through tax reform or tax change. And as you look around the country, no states are adopting the method that currently exists in Oregon. And as a jurisdiction, this state has been, like single sales factor, has been on the front edge of a lot of the new thinking on how to tax the business community. So this isn't novel in that respect. I would say that Oregon has always been a little progressive in terms of tax policy. Not always agree with, but I mean, it's pretty progressive.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. This has been, I'm starting to understand this. That's maybe alarming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anybody else who wants to speak on this? Looking back there in the next to the last row, I guess we don't have anybody. And then Chris, did you describe the Dash 8 amendment?
Madam Chair, I had not. Just to back up a little bit, what you have in all this, you have the fiscal impact statement and the revenue impact statement, which it sounds like the committee has looked at. So you have all of the paperwork in terms of the original bill. You have the Dash A8, and you have the revenue impact statement for the Dash A8, and it is unchanged from the Dash A. We are waiting on a fiscal impact statement for the Dash A8.
Okay.
But what the AA does, the relevant part of it, is just on lines 2-4 of that amendment. And it adds clarifying language, adds language to clarify that the interstate broadcasters who are affected by this apportionment method is unchanged. On the House side, there was some confusion, kind of a two-step process. Who is affected by this kind of apportionment, and how is the income apportioned? The policy intent of the bill is to only affect how the apportionment is done. It is not intended to increase or decrease or change in any way who is affected by it.
Right.
And that's what the amendment in AA does. It adds additional language. There was concern that may not be as clear as it could be, that the intent wasn't as clear as it could be. So this is language that adds that intent, which is why the revenue impact statement did not change, and we don't expect the fiscal impact statement to change.
And I'll get into this in the carrying statement, because this is a key element of legislative intent. The industry, everything is changing so rapidly in this whole line of business that there may be a future time when the universe we're talking about changes or doesn't change, gets smaller or larger, but it's not the purpose of this bill to have any impact whatsoever on who's in the tax class and who's not. But it's also not the intent of this bill to preclude the inclusion of other people if the technology evolves in such a way and that policy decision is made. So all we can say is that this bill in the Dash A8 makes it clear this bill in itself does not have any impact at all on who's in the class that's affected by this apportionment. So, any other questions for Chris? We don't have a fiscal yet committee, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4138, and we will hold this over till Wednesday. It did? Yeah, we're going to hold it over anyway. But this is a lot to absorb. I think we can send and reconnect. Yeah, committee, I'm going to open up a work session on the most boring bill of the session, House Bill 4003. Chris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Please don't put us to sleep.
I will be very brief. This is the reconnect bill. You have all of the paperwork. There's no fiscal impact. There's no revenue impact. And Congress didn't do much last year, so there isn't much to connect to. It's just a housekeeping in terms of keeping the date up to date so that when CPAs go to look at the tax law, they can see December 31st of the most recent year, which is December 31st, 2013.
Does anyone disagree with me that this is the most boring bill of the session? Okay. With that said,
favorite bill of the session.
Senator George, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4003 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 4003 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Hess, you want to carry it? No, you can carry it. You can carry it.
The most boring bill in the entire session, you're not going to let me carry it?
The Vice Chair of Boring will carry the boring bill.
You better have Senator Thompson do it.
Okay. Committee, that completes our business today, and we will be meeting again Wednesday, and hopefully not a whole lot of meetings after that.
Okay.
So with that, we are adjourned.
Is that three on Wednesday?
Huh?
Is it three?
Huh?
Is it three?